at VOA1 The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today, Brian Lynn presents this week's technology report. He tells us about ways governments aim to protect citizens from harmful artificial intelligence systems. We close the show with the next part of our American History series. But first, Katie Weaver has this report.
The social media site Facebook is under increasing pressure to provide reparations to Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh. The rights group Amnesty International has accused Facebook and its owner, Meta, of serious wrongdoing against the refugees from Myanmar. In a report released last week, Amnesty said Meta's programming proactively amplified and promoted content that incited violent hatred against the Rohingya. The report said the content began to appear on Facebook as early as 2012. The investigators said the company failed to remove violent posts and lies and helped to spread such posts. Amnesty said the final result of Meta's actions were the 2017 killings of Rohingya in Myanmar. At the same time, Facebook's popularity was growing in Myanmar. For many people there, it served as their only connection to the online world. That made Facebook the main internet connection for a large part of Myanmar's population. More than 700,000 Rohingya fled to neighboring Bangladesh in 2017. Myanmar security forces, the Tatmadaw, were accused of killings, rapes, and other torture, as well as the burning of Rohingya villages. The Associated Press asked Meta about the Amnesty report. The company did not answer. In a statement, the company said it stands in solidarity with the international community and supports efforts to hold the Tatmadaw accountable for its crimes against the Rohingya people. Rafael Franco is Director of Public Policy for Emerging Markets at Meta Asia Pacific. He said in a statement, "Our safety and integrity work in Myanmar remains guided by feedback from local civil society organizations and international institutions, including the UN Fact-Finding Mission on Myanmar, the human rights impact assessment we commissioned in 2018, as well as our ongoing human rights risk management. About 1 million Rohingya remain in camps. Most are in Bangladesh. They are demanding that Meta pay reparations for its part in the violent repression of Rohingya Muslims in Myanmar. Earlier this year, the United States declared that situation a genocide." The Amnesty findings are based on reports from Rohingya refugees, former Meta employees, experts, activists, and others. Investigators also used documents provided to the U.S. Congress last year by whistleblower Francis Hagen, a former Facebook data scientist. The report noted that digital rights activists say Meta has improved its supervision in Myanmar in recent years. In January 2021, After a violent government overthrow, Meta barred the Myanmar military from its site. But critics, including some Facebook employees, have argued that the current methods will never truly work. Meta's programming is really dangerous to our human rights, says Pat De Bruin, lawyer and researcher on artificial intelligence and human rights at Amnesty. What happened to the Rohingya and Facebook's part in the conflict, he continued, risks happening again in many different contexts across the world. The company has shown itself completely unwilling or incapable of resolving the root causes of its human rights impact, De Bruin said. After a 2018 UN report denounced Meta's actions in Myanmar, the company admitted that it was not doing enough to help prevent the incitement of violence. It changed some policies and the way it supervised the site over the next few years and claimed great success. But the Amnesty report said the new measures were not enough. The Rohingya refugees have not said what form the reparations should take. Meta is also the subject of two legal actions in the U.S. and Britain seeking $150 billion for Rohingya refugees. Meta has refused to consider reparations. We believe that the genocide against Rohingya was possible only because of Facebook, said one refugee in the report. They communicated with each other to spread hate. They organized campaigns through Facebook, but Facebook was silent. I'm Katie Weaver.
The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden has proposed new guidelines aimed at protecting citizens from the harmful effects of artificial intelligence systems. The guidelines are known as the Blueprint for an AI Bill of Rights. A blueprint is a plan that shows how someone will design, build, or reach a goal. The proposal is not a set of rules and does not include specific enforcement actions. It is meant to influence AI system developers to safeguard digital and civil rights. The guidelines were created by the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. They were released as AI systems increasingly expand to many different parts of society. The plan identifies five areas that aim to guide the design, use, and deployment of automated systems to protect the American public in the age of artificial intelligence. The guidelines were established over the past year in cooperation with many government agencies, the administration said in a statement. Officials took advice from civil society groups, technologists, industry researchers, and major technology companies. U.S. officials told the Associated Press the blueprint represents progress in administration efforts to hold technology companies responsible for the AI systems they develop and deploy. The guidelines are designed to limit the effects of bias in AI systems. Critics of AI have noted many cases in which automated systems have misidentified or discriminated against people based on their race or sex. Several studies and news reports have documented harms that resulted from AI-powered tools. For example, facial recognition systems used by law enforcement agencies have led to wrongful arrests. In one incident, an automated system discriminated against individuals seeking financial assistance at historically black colleges. In another case, AI systems used to administer health care discriminated against black patients. An administration official told reporters such examples demonstrate that some AI systems are causing real harms in the lives of Americans. The official added that irresponsible AI systems go against democratic values, including the fundamental right to privacy and freedom from discrimination. The guidelines also urge AI developers to build tools into systems to give users control over their data. And developers are urged to ensure that automated systems are used safely and transparently. Some technology industry experts have warned that such measures could hurt some American businesses if the guidelines become rules. The head of the non-government U.S. Chamber of Commerce, Jordan Crenshaw, said he would not like to see the guidelines enacted into U.S. law. If this happens, it could handcuff America's ability to compete in AI development with other countries. In Europe, such proposals have developed much further. Last year, the European Union proposed a set of rules meant to govern AI technology. EU lawmakers are currently debating the proposals, which cover areas such as automated surveillance, privacy protections, and system bias. The rules are known as the Artificial Intelligence Act. Some groups have warned that the EU proposals could create bureaucratic barriers for technology businesses. The proposals would put strong rules in place and fine violators. The U.S.-based policy group Brookings Institution recently criticized one part of the Artificial Intelligence Act. It said the EU's plan to put limits on open-source AI could further concentrate power over the future of AI in large technology companies. Open-source AI is an artificial intelligence technology that the public and companies may use without cost. Brookings said that limiting this kind of AI would lead to two kinds of harm. It would keep many AI systems under the control of big, established technology companies and would deny small businesses the chance to develop new AI tools. In addition, the proposed EU rules would limit valuable research and decrease the openness of widely used AI systems, Brookings said. I'm Brian Lynn.
VOA Learning English has launched a new program for children. It is called Let's Learn English with Anna. The new course aims to teach children American English through asking and answering questions and experiencing fun situations. For more information, visit our website, learningenglish.voanews.com.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. Today we begin the story of Alexander Hamilton. He was one of the country's founding fathers. He never became president. He did, however, become the country's first Secretary of the Treasury. At that time, the American government was very weak. It had many debts and no money. Many of the country's citizens did not support their own government. Many wondered if America would last. In a few years, however, there was a change. This change was produced in large part by the energy and imagination of one man, Alexander Hamilton. Hamilton wanted to make America a strong and important nation. He wanted it to become the equal of the powerful nations of Europe. There is much mystery about the early days of Alexander Hamilton. Some facts about his childhood and youth have been clearly established. Others have not. Historians think he was born around 1755 or 1757. His mother was the daughter of French Huguenots who had settled in the British West Indies. Her name was Rachel Lavien. Historians are not sure who his father was. One story says he may have been James Hamilton, a poor businessman from Scotland. Rachel Lavien lived with him after she left her husband. One thing is certain. His mother died when he was 11 years old. When she died, friends of the family found work for the boy on the island of St. Croix, then called Santa Cruz, in the Virgin Islands. He became an assistant bookkeeper and learned how to keep financial records. Young Alexander was not like the other children. Other children played games. He talked about becoming a political leader in the North American colonies. He read every book that was given to him in English, French, Latin, and Greek. At a young age, he learned a great deal about business and economics, and he developed an ability to communicate ideas clearly and powerfully.
He showed great talents as a writer, very observant, and gained notice when he wrote an account of a local hurricane, which was picked up by the local press.
Valerie Paley is a historian at the New York Historical Society. She says Hamilton's writing was so good that his boss and some other people decided to help him get a good education. They gave him money so he could attend a college in New York City. The boy's plan was to study medicine and return to St. Croix as a doctor. But he never lived in the West Indies again. At King's College in New York City, both teachers and students were surprised by Hamilton's intelligence and clear way of communicating. He often expressed his thinking about the problems of the American colonies. Hamilton was against British rule. He wrote a paper defending the colonists in the city of Boston who seized a British ship and threw its cargo of tea into the water. The protest over taxes became known as the Boston Tea Party. Valerie Paley of the New York Historical Society says Hamilton's upbringing may have influenced his views.
Some historians have argued that he was somewhat stateless. He was adrift. He was his own man. And in a way, there was something so passionately right for Hamilton in joining something as apparently important as the revolutionary cause.
The year 1776 arrived. The 13 American colonies declared their independence from Britain. The declaration meant war. The American Revolution gave Hamilton the chance to show his abilities. He became part of a New York militia and fought in some important early battles. It was not long before Hamilton met the commander-in-chief of American forces, George Washington. General Washington recognized Hamilton's talents. He promoted Hamilton and invited him to become an aide. In that job, Hamilton wrote letters and reports for Washington. Hamilton had to use all his political and communication skills to get money and supplies for the Revolutionary Army. He asked the 13 state governments. He also asked the Congress, which had little political power at that time. He got almost no help from either. Hamilton came to believe firmly that the American system of government was too weak and disorganized. Even so, historian Valerie Paley says Hamilton became one of the most important people on George Washington's staff.
Hamilton had never had a father, of course, that he knew or knew well, so there was something very, very loyal and very, very trusting about the relationship between the men. So I think it was extremely important and influential to Hamilton's growth as a politician and as a thinker.
She says their relationship was almost like a father and son. But that did not mean their relationship was always good. Alexander Hamilton was a proud man. He was quick to criticize others. He even criticized George Washington. Once, during the war, Hamilton was late to a meeting with the general. Washington protested. Hamilton resigned. For the next 8 years, Hamilton was very busy. He led troops in some of the last battles of the American Revolution. He became a lawyer. He founded the Bank of New York, one of the very first banks in the country. He helped save his old school, King's College, and turn it into what is now Columbia University. He was a delegate to the Constitutional Convention. He wrote some of the Federalist Papers, among the most famous documents in American history. Hamilton's defense of a strong central government persuaded many Americans to ratify the Constitution and establish a new system of government. Historian Valerie Paley says Hamilton had a visionary way of thinking about the world.
He thought up, some would argue, the whole notion of what modern America is in terms of the way government works, in terms of finance, banking. He saw the importance of certain structures we take for granted before they even existed.
All Hamilton needed was a way to make his ideas happen. George Washington gave Hamilton that power. When Washington became president, he forgot their disagreement during the war. He asked his former aide to become the country's first Secretary of the Treasury. The job would be difficult.
The United States at that time was a financial basket case.
Business historian John Steele Gordon wrote a book about Hamilton.
There was no real money supply. In the colonial days, they had used a hodgepodge of coins from British and Spanish and Portuguese and what have you. It's a very chaotic system.
In other words, there was no such thing yet as American money. John Steele Gorton says America also had to borrow heavily to pay for the Revolutionary War. The new nation was deeply in debt. It had to find ways to bring in money and pay what it owed. One way to get money was to borrow it. But no one wanted to lend money to the United States unless they were sure they would get it back. So the Congress asked Treasury Secretary Hamilton to write a report about how to build up the government's credit. Hamilton's report said the government must pay back the full amount of all its debts. This caused a dispute. Many of the debts were in the form of government notes. The notes promised to pay someone for supplying food, clothing, and weapons to the rebel army. Some promised to pay soldiers for joining the army. The notes, however, were really worth nothing. The wartime Congress had no money. People who got them lost hope of ever getting repaid. So they sold them to anyone willing to pay even part of the value. Hamilton's plan would repay the full value of the notes to those who owned them last. Hamilton believed that those who bought the notes had a right to earn money from them. He said these men took a chance that the worthless notes would be worth something someday. Congressman James Madison of Virginia protested. He said the people who bought the notes at low cost should be paid, but not in full. Some of the money, he said, should go to those who got the notes in exchange for supplies or services. Madison made an emotional speech in Congress. He described the situation of former soldiers forced by hunger to sell their government notes for almost nothing. He noted that the Union was established to protect the people against such injustice. Hamilton answered that the purpose of his plan was greater than simply paying debts. He said it was a way to build up the nation's credit so it could borrow money more easily in the future. Many members of Congress felt sorry for the poor soldiers and their families. Yet, they voted against Madison's proposal and supported Hamilton's plan. Still, to win support for his plan, Hamilton had to make a political deal with several congressmen. They would support his financial plan, but he had to use his influence to get the capital of the United States moved. At that time, the Capitol was in the north, in New York City. Two congressmen from Virginia wanted it in the south, near their homes along the Potomac River. Several congressmen from Pennsylvania agreed, but they said the Capitol must first be moved to the city of Philadelphia in their state, and it must remain there for 10 years. Congress accepted this plan by a close vote. President Washington signed it into law. Hamilton was still a young man in his 30s, but he had already succeeded in remaking the country's economic policies, and he had established the country's permanent capital in Washington, D.C., the District of Columbia. He had also made some enemies. His next plan would create even more.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak.